Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christine O'Loury, covering KHSC's appointment of Dr. Doris Jabs to Clinical Chair of Breast Health.
Hello, I'm Christine O'Loury, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
A $1 million fundraising pledge from the annual Rose of Hope Ladies Golf Tournament has made it possible to fund a new clinical chair position at Kingston Health Sciences Center. After raising $3.5 million over its 27-year history in support of women's health at KHSC, this year's tournament set its sights on a new, ambitious goal: establishing the Rose of Hope Clinical Chair in Breast Health at Kingston Health Sciences Center. KHSC has announced that Dr. Doris Jabs will be taking on this new leadership role. A women's imaging radiologist with more than two decades of experience, Dr. Jabs is also the longtime regional breast imaging lead for the Ontario Breast Screening Program and one of the driving forces behind the creation of KHSC's Breast Imaging Kingston, BIC, a state-of-the-art breast cancer screening and diagnostic facility. Dr. Jab sat down with CFRC to share what this appointment means for her and the future of breast health in Kingston.
So the Rose of Hope Clinical Chair in Breast Health is truly, it's an inaugural position, and it really is an honor for me to be in this role. I've been in Kingston as a breast radiologist for, I don't want to give away my age, but I'm moving on to my end of my second decade, and breast imaging truly is a passion for me. I enjoy every day going to work. I enjoy my work. I enjoy the people I work with, and I enjoy the people that I am providing a service to. This position is very special. So this position moves us from the excellent technology that we have, the amazing facility at Breast Imaging Kingston, which if you haven't been to, you really should at least zip by to see how special it is, to a more transformative position, which is now going to bring all that technology together with the expertise that we have in the city, which is excellent across multiple disciplines. So we have expertise in primary care, family physicians, in imaging, breast radiology, oncology, surgery, pathology. And this position now is going to marry all that together, or attempt to marry all that together, and find gaps that we can close in innovative ways, thinking out of the box, in a real patient-centered or a client-centered approach. So this is going to be all about the women, the people that we serve. It's going to be about making their journey quicker, simpler, hopefully less anxiety-laden together.
According to KHSC, unlike funding for a single piece of equipment, a clinical chair position provides the time and resources for a physician to drive innovation in care, research, and education. Dr. Jabs explained the transformative power of a clinical chair role and some of her goals walking into the position.
So a clinical chair, I believe the other position that we have is in genomics. The clinical chair is very different. So the way the system currently works is we have all these specialties that do have heads of department and heads of sections, and they're all excellent in and of their own right. The surgeons are excellent, the pathologists are excellent, the radiologists, the primary care, they're all very good, but it's a bit siloed. From a patient perspective, in any case, I think it's a bit siloed. And so although everybody is doing excellent work in their area, you need somebody or something or a role to be able to tie that all together, right, for the people that experience the care. So we as care providers are excellent care providers in our area, but the people that we care for actually move within all those different areas. And so it's to bring all of that together. And that is a very unique role that we currently have at KGH. It is very forward thinking. I'm very excited to be in this position.
And what kinds of innovation are you looking to explore? What are you excited about?
I can't give away all of my secrets, of course, right? It's going to be iterative. So I certainly have some ideas already that we're rolling out that we're going to try and bring sort of some that we can do very quickly, others that will take a little bit longer. I think one of the most important things is I'm really keen on getting a rapid access type service going at the BIC. So this can be done in many different ways, but basically it's a way to have women be seen quicker in a seamless way. We definitely are going to be updating ourselves and bringing in all the new technologies that we have. We have AI platforms, we have digital technologies, we have social media, we have all these innovative technological tools available that I think have been perhaps maybe a little bit underused. So I'm certainly going to try and bring some of those in. We have to reach out to our underserved communities. That is a definite gap that we need to address. And so those are sort of some of our initial initiatives.
Yeah. And I mean, you kind of dove into this right there, but I was wondering if you could speak to some of the challenges that we're facing in breast health and those first things that you're really wanting to address when you walk into this position.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is just my personal experience and what I've gleaned over my years of working in the field. I think some of the barriers that we have in breast health is there's some fear around it. Certainly, there are some groups that are very keen on getting screened and keen on their breast health. There are others that don't know. So education is a huge gap that we need to fill. People may just not know about what they need to do for their breast health. And then there are others, I think, that are anxious and have fears which may have a foundation, fears which may not be grounded. And so I think those are all barriers to getting screened, to being an advocate for your breast health, to getting things done. And so we need to really increase our screen participation rate in the region. That's the key thing in breast health, right? It's all about breast screening. It's all about detection. And the OBSP, the Ontario Breast Screening Program, which is our provincial breast screening program, has recently dropped the age of screen. So historically, women from the age of 50 to 72 were invited to the breast screening program, and we've now dropped that to 40. So I think there's a huge group of people out there that we could now access that may or may not even know that this is what's available for them. So it's sort of trying to take away the fear a little bit, to decrease the anxiety through education and absolutely through accessibility.
This year's Rose of Hope tournament raised $285,000, the first installment of their five-year pledge.
The Rose of Hope is very special. They are a very energizing and inspiring group of women. Although I've been aware of the Rose of Hope and we've had them support multiple technologies at the BIC, our MRI is coming online early 2026. They were fundamental in other technologies at the BIC to include our prone biopsy table and prone biopsy device. So they're not new to me. I'm not new to them. But the Rose of Hope tournament this year, which was all about this clinical chair position and their fundraising for that, was truly humbling, inspiring, energizing, all at the same time. These women are a very dedicated group of women to truly improve the care that the women in our region are receiving. It's fantastic.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for The Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forestell, with a story about a program in Kingston schools designed to prevent gender-based violence.
Thank you, Jesse. A new partnership between the John Howard Society of Kingston and District and the Sexual Assault Center Kingston has culminated in the launch of Rewire, Empowering Youth for Healthy Relationships, a new early intervention program aimed at preventing gender-based violence. Funded by the Ministry of Children, Community and Social Services as part of Ontario's action plan to end gender-based violence, this innovative group-based initiative will be delivered to students and staff across local school boards, including the Limestone District School Board and the Algonquin and Lakeshore Catholic District School Board. According to a press release from the John Howard Society and SAC Kingston, Rewire is designed to engage youth in meaningful conversations about healthy relationships, emotional intelligence, and responsible behavior both online and offline. The program supports area staff and students in engaging in meaningful conversations about healthy relationships. According to research by Dr. Wendy Craig of Queen's University, many educators feel underprepared in this area. By leveraging community-based expertise and emerging trends in GBV prevention, Rewire offers a proactive, evidence-informed approach to fostering safer, more respectful relationships, according to program organizers. For those coordinating the program, having two local agencies with established visibility and experience team up to offer Rewire is pivotal in addressing GBV. Julia Langan, Executive Director of the John Howard Society of Kingston and District, stated that Rewire will create a space where young people can learn, grow, and challenge harmful norms in a supportive environment. Ultimately, the program's goal is to break the cycle of GBV and prevent future justice involvement. For more information about the Rewire program or to inquire about participation, contact Julia Langan at julie.langan@jhskd.ca. Thank you to Michelle Dory Forstel for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with a story from the LJR reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about the growing rift between Mayor John Beddoes and the Gananoque Town Council.
Thank you, Dinah. A dispute over the cost of a judicial review currently underway has spilled into the public arena, with Gananoque Mayor John Beddoes and members of Town Council engaging in a pointed exchange on social media. The judicial review stems from a May decision by Beddoes to challenge Council's suspension of his pay and requirement for a formal apology. The disciplinary action followed a report by Gananoque's Integrity Commissioner, which concluded that Beddoes had committed 8 breaches of the Municipal Code of Conduct. In June, Council directed staff to retain legal counsel in response to the Mayor's judicial review application, setting the stage for the ongoing debate over who bears the cost of legal process. Beddoes reignited the discussion on August 24th, posting publicly on Facebook, quote, "I am upfronting all of my own costs. The cost to the town, if any, of the judicial review process is at the discretion of the rest of the council," unquote. The post drew immediate responses from council members. Deputy Mayor Vicky Leakey questioned Beddoes' assertion of council discretion, noting that council followed due process under the Municipal Act by referring concerns to the Independent Integrity Commissioner. Quote, "Thank you for covering your own costs, but you are aware in these circumstances there may be time where the town needs legal protection for their own defense," Leakey wrote. Beddoes responded by pointing to the public minutes of a June 25th closed session of council, where he attended briefly to ensure quorum before recusing himself due to pecuniary interest. Councillor David Osman later joined the online discussion, challenging Beddoes' framing of events. Osman argued that Beddoes' actions in initiating legal action directly limited council's ability to support staff during the review. He also pushed back on the mayor's claim that the cost to taxpayers depended on council discretion. The online exchange highlights growing tension between Beddoes and his council colleagues, as well as ongoing public scrutiny of the judicial review process. Town staff members have not yet commented on the matter.
And thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to LJR reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the possibility of legal action against Greater Napanee from Lennox and Addington related to a homeless encampment protocol map.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, Local Journalism Initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
Greater Napanee is potentially facing legal action from its own county. The town received correspondence from a law firm representing Lennox and Addington demanding that Greater Napanee stop distributing an encampment protocol map that identifies county lands as public property. The county has given the town 7 days as of August 25th before legal action will be taken. Following negative interactions between housed and unhoused individuals, the town looked into several legal opinions on an encampment protocol designed to provide a greater level of predictability in the community. community. Staff developed the encampment protocol map, and it has since been used regularly. Staff noted that in the absence of any formal guidance from housing authorities on how to deal with the increasing level of encampments, they would be reluctant to remove this form of guidance. CAO with the Town of Greater Napanee, Matthew Grant, explains the legal action and what started it off for the county.
The legal action is about the town's use of the map, which identifies those public spaces. The issue of litigation arose after a tent appeared on county property at 97 Thomas Street. The argument is that by identifying public lands on a map that case law has deemed accessible to homeless individuals, we are encouraging people to go there.
Grant explained what happened on the day of the complaint.
We hadn't received any complaints about the map until August 13th of this year. That was the same day a homeless individual set up a tent on county lands at 97 Thomas Street. Bylaw was notified of this issue by a community partner in writing. Bylaw was later called to that site after an employee at the county of Lennox and Addington reportedly told the homeless individual and some outreach workers that they had to leave the property or law enforcement would be contacted. On late, you know, in the day on August 13th, I was contacted by the chief administrative officer of the county of Lennox and Addington, telling me they had concerns about the individual on their property. And they were also concerned that bylaw services at the town of Greater Napanee was directing people to that property. I know that is not true, and I did convey that. And I have seen the documentation that proves that.
Staff's report noted that in 2024, Greater Napanee experienced a surge in encampments, with the majority located on property owned by the town. Case law in other municipalities around the province has established that unhoused individuals have a constitutional right to shelter themselves on public property if there is an insufficient supply of shelter and public housing in the community. Grant speaks about the current housing situations in Napanee.
In Greater Napanee, affordable housing and homelessness programming is the responsibility of the County of Lennox and Addington and Prince Edward and Lennox and Addington Social Services. Case law, provincially and federally, has deemed that people have the constitutional right to shelter themselves on public property if there is not enough shelter or affordable housing within a community. That case law has been tried and tested in Waterloo, in Kingston, and in Hamilton, and is applicable to all public lands. And in the town of Greater Napanee, we do not have any shelters, and we do not have enough affordable housing.
Grant spoke about the reasoning behind creating the encampment protocol map.
I will take us back to 2024, when the town was experiencing a very difficult time where there was conflict and even violence with the situation around encampments. And candidly, my perspective is that's because the situation was unpredictable. In 2024, in a bid to make things more predictable, to allow people to have access to their parks, as well as providing spaces, in awareness where individuals could exercise their constitutional rights and minimize negative interaction that we experienced in 2024. We developed a parks bylaw and an encampment protocol.
Bylaw officer with the town of Greater Napanee, Arthur Cook, explained how they use the map in the town.
The map is one of our main communication tools when we are interacting with both the public and members of our in-house community in Greater Napanee. It's a main tool that we include in educational handouts. It exists on the backs of orders that we issue, and we have circulated it to the partner agencies that are also working on this issue alongside the town. It is a tool that is easy to understand, that allows us to be able to show people where in a space and time they actually are. For example, if we were interacting with an individual, the public in Conservation Park, we're actually able to show on the map where we are for that interaction. It's a relatively clear, simple, straightforward way that anybody with any level or degree of education or understanding of Napanee can understand.
Cook went on to explain the map doesn't direct people to certain areas, nor do members of staff.
We use the map as a tool to show what areas are sensitive use areas. So per the bylaw, the red spaces on the map where individuals cannot encamp. And we do not direct anybody to any one particular specific location.
Grant spoke about the feedback they received while creating the map.
We included public property on that particular communications instrument. And we did a series of consultation with stakeholders. In terms of feedback, we received specifically from partners at the County of Lansing, Addington, and Pelas. The feedback we received from a member of their management team was to remove their phone number from the map that we were using. The rest of the phone numbers from different partner organizations, including our own, remains.
Grant went on to detail the timeline of communications they received from the county.
On the 15th of August, it was indicated to me that the county was engaging legal counsel. Later that day, I received correspondence from a solicitor representing the County of Lansing-Addington asking us to stop distributing the map while they conducted a legal review. On August 25th, our solicitors received a cease and desist order demanding that we no longer distribute the encampment protocol map or and stop doing that within 7 calendar days or face litigation. We have been asked to cease and desist using that map. We've also been asked to remove certain lands from that map.
Grant spoke about the usefulness of the map for town staff.
It's important to note, I think, that the map in and of itself, there's nothing illegal about it. It is a lawful document and a useful document, I would suggest. We did go above and beyond to consult the public and our stakeholders on the issue, including the map. We did reach out to all stakeholders, including leadership of the county and Pelas, on the map specifically a year ago. We created the protocol to deal with encampments and to bring predictability in the absence of a clear and coherent strategy around this issue by housing authorities, and it's working. You know, nobody wants this, but I would suggest we're able to manage this better than in 2024, and we're learning.
In response to the legal action, staff will be sending formal correspondence to the county, encouraging them to create their own bylaw governing encampments on their property. They will also be asking the county to develop, publicly consult on, and deploy a strategy for how encampments can be managed. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about Coburg Mayor Lucas Cleveland's use of the controversial strong mayor powers.
I've heard enough of the discussion to feel that anything I might have to say is rather futile.
That was Coburg resident Jennifer Darrell reacting to information that she nor council had many options in opposing a strong mayor powers decision by Coburg Mayor Lucas Cleveland to completely restructure the town's planning and development department and appoint a person who has no education in planning to lead that department. Chris Challenger, who was the office manager to Chief Administrative Officer Tracy Vaughn, was appointed August 15th with a probation period of 6 to 12 months. In defending his decision, Cleveland said that he consulted internally with bureaucrats and other high-level officials in the town hall before making the decision, adding that speeding up development is paramount for Coburg. Yet he admitted he wanted to bypass council.
I'm not worried about the professionals in our field, nor am I worried about their skills or their abilities. What I've done is I've basically, with the mayor direct, I've done what wasn't possible previously without a full council buy-in. An organization like this would require the entire majority of council to agree that this change is worth trying.
For approximately 45 minutes Monday night, several councillors expressed frustration with Cleveland's decision, not only questioning the best hiring practices, but the financial impacts to the town for essentially creating a new development department and staffing it. Deputy Mayor Nicole Beattie was concerned that a staff report on the cost was not presented to council. Cleveland said a financial study has not been conducted, but one will be done shortly as the department develops with the hiring of a deputy director. Councillor Adam Burkatt speculated Cleveland's decision will be harmful.
I think this particular directive is quite honestly more harmful than moving the department forward, I'll be honest. And I would have no issue if it was a matter of you appointing somebody that, you know, if they had credentials and they're a planner as an interim, or even appointing somebody from the internally in the department as an interim until we went through the proper scheduling or hiring of a planner.
Coburg and 169 other Ontario municipalities were granted additional powers by the provincial government May 1st. This includes appointing department heads, police and fire chiefs, and making decisions outside of council approval, which have been deemed provincial priorities. Town of Cobourg solicitor John Mascarin said there is not much council can do when strong mayor powers are invoked other than monitor the financial impacts to the town. Anthony Dew of Stalwood Homes, who is also a member of the Northumberland Contracting and Builders Association, agreed with Cleveland that speed is essential to development and that integrating these departments prevents working in silos. Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, September 4th, the first non-sunny day in the forecast. Daytime high of 21 degrees with a 64% chance of precipitation. A lot of wind and a lot of rain predicted for Thursday. Moving into Friday, we get the remnants of that Thursday rainy day with a daytime high of 18 degrees. A couple rain clouds here and there, but largely it's going to be a beautiful day here in the city of Kingston, just in time for the Queens game against the Laurier Golden Hawks under the lights at Richardson Stadium. Moving into the first weekend of September, Saturday, September 6th, daytime high of 17 with about a 50% chance of rain, and Sunday, September 7th, 17 degrees as well, but with lots of bright sunshine, and then moving into the start of next week, Monday, September 8th, 17 degrees and sunny.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.